Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is time for America's Most Haunted Radio. I'm Eric Olson. Very excited to be here this evening. We will be talking Bates Motel and lots of other things with the outstanding actor Nestor Carbonell. In Bates Motel, the Psycho prequel series on A&E, which is Mondays at 10 p.m., the astonishingly flexible Nestor Carbonell plays Sheriff Alex Romero riding herd over White Pine Bay, the unhinged drama's fictional setting. Romero is the moral center of the town, although morality is relative in this upscale human sewer. Imposing and discerning, Romero got involved in Norma Bates' life after an unfortunate incident at the motel early in season one. And I have to chuckle at that because the entire show is a series of unfortunate incidents. That is for sure. I am the last person who you want on your bad side, Mrs. Bates. He intoned with stony seriousness. This season he has become, perhaps against his better judgment, even more involved with the Bateses residing at the motel after his house was torched by a reckless local drug kingpin involved with Norma's son, Dylan. And he has become friendly and uneasily, perhaps, familiar with Norma. Nestor Carbonell was born in New York City and variously raised in Mexico, Venezuela, Florida, Connecticut, the Bahamas, and London. He graduated from Harvard University with a degree in English, where a first-year drama course led to his interest in performing. Nestor is most often recognized for his integral role in the acclaimed series Lost as the iconic and mysterious Richard Alpert. This role, as well as his turn as Mayor Anthony Garcia in Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight series, has shown Nestor's versatility, range, and complexity as an actor. Holy cow, his additional TV credits include Ringer, Kane, House, Scrubs, Monk, and Suddenly Susan, going way back, for which he earned two ALMA Awards for Outstanding Actor in a Comedy Series. He currently resides in Los Angeles with his wife, actress Shannon Kenny, and their two sons. Wow, that is a mouthful, and not a moment too soon. I believe that we have Nestor Carbonell on the phone. Is that in fact true?
I have Nestor.
Excellent. I am Eric.
Hey, Eric, how are you?
I am wondrous. I had exactly the right amount of time to read your astonishing list of credits. It was perfect timing.
You're very kind. You're very kind.
Well, you know, I was talking to people about doing the show, and my wife, of course, but then lots of other people and doing the social media. And, you know, everyone's watching Bates Motel, so they know you from that. But then I start tossing out all those other things. They go, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, that guy, he is so good. And all the women go,
oh,
yeah, yeah, and he's
you.
Really good looking and everything. And I go, yeah, well, maybe.
Yeah, whatever. No. No, well, I appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks for doing this. You know, I love the show, and I'm so thrilled when people are excited to talk about it. So it's a great thing for all of us. All of us.
I literally just finished this week's episode. I mean, just before.
Oh,
I think it was 9:58 when I finished the the online video of it. And that's great, by the way. People should know that you can watch, I think it's the previous five episodes, full episodes. I had
no problems.
No hiccups, no interruptions. It was,
absolutely.
I mean, there's commercials, but, you know. But, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, you can watch all of them right there online. It's terrific. It's a great site. So, anyway,
no, it really is.
Wow. Drama.
Yeah, there's a lot of drama, especially now heating up with the finale next Monday. They've ramped things up, and Carlton Cuse, our head writer and creator, and Carrie Aaron as well. how they set up so much, you know, early on in the season, and it's, you know, it's payoff time. Now now we get to see, you know, without giving anything away, but a lot of great resolution.
I'm not sure who is the ultimate heavyweight stud on the show. I don't know if it's you or Dylan. What do you think?
You know, that's a great question. I think, you know, and I think you'll get some answers next week. I think, I honestly, without being too cryptic, but I think that remains to be seen, but there will be some element of that question answered next week. And you're right. There is a lot of just, you know, power shifting. And we'll, you know, and there has been, and there's, it was sort of since the beginning of this particular season, it was introduced when my character had a scene with Nick Ford that, you know, as much as I might have given the impression that I was the one in charge, clearly there were other entities or these two feuding, you know, drug lord families that were keeping the town afloat. So I was sort of, you know, caught in the middle. So I definitely did not hold, you know, the keys to the town as I thought of, as I might have given off. But yeah, next week, next Monday, we will definitely find out who's in control and who's not in control.
Well, after that episode, we know it is no longer Nick Ford.
Definitely not longer Nick Ford, no doubt about it. And which sort of begs the question, you know, if Nick Ford is gone, you know, we still have, you know, we have the other family. We have the Morgans. We have Zane Morgan and his sister. And so who knows what's going to happen? That, you know, who knows what's, you know, is it one family that's going to take over? You know, so we'll find that out for sure.
And even within the families, there's obviously struggle. Definitely the end, right here at the end, when Dylan showed up at Zane's hideout, it was definitely cast Zane in a different light. He was a lot more calm, a lot more authoritative.
Oh, yeah.
Even his voice was different, I noticed.
Absolutely. He sort of, I think he sensed something, obviously, was up, and he was clearly holed up, and he felt that he was a target to some extent. And you're right, even the way he talked to Dylan was more measured and purposeful and more in control. Usually he's out of control, and he definitely felt more in control. So, yeah, so that's sort of, that may or may not allude to, you know, who sort of takes control next week.
What's really interesting about you is, on the one hand, you're very flexible, and we've seen lots of range and depth, but there's also a certain center, a commonality at the center of your most, you know, iconic, I guess, roles, your best known roles, where you're generally quiet and generally slow to anger, but there's a lot of weight. There's a lot of authority there. And I'm just wondering, is this something that's written in the characters that you just kind of happen to have played? Or is that something that you are bringing to those various roles? I think, you know, I'm thinking especially about the sheriff, of course, some similar kind of authority and literal authority as well, also similarly in the Dark Knight films, and some similar personality and approach and way of dealing with people, and similar kind of depth and mystery in Lost. Any
well,
thoughts on that? I'm just sort of talking off the top of my head, but that was occurring to me
It's a really great question. It's a really great observation. I think, you know, it's interesting working with Carlton now, having the privilege of working with him twice on Lost and now on Bates Motel. It's the situation was certainly with Lost, like that particular character. You know, his background was sort of undetermined. When I came into it, was really just to fulfill a flashback episode to introduce, not to introduce, but to further explain Juliet's history. And it grew from there, but it was already a character shrouded in mystery. We didn't know who he was, and then we later learned, slowly learned a little bit more about him until his past was revealed. So I brought an element, I guess, I wanted to bring some level of calmness to that character because I needed for Julia to trust me. So I wanted to play against any kind of sinister vibe. I wanted her to fully trust me. So even though I was doing some horrible things, trying to kill her ex-husband to get her on the island, trust was a major issue. And so I sort of leaned on that. And then the writers, typically in TV and the long form, they write to the strength of the actor. They will, or to the strength that they think the actor brings to the role or an interesting angle. So I imagine the writers from then on started writing towards the element of mystery and the Machiavellian nature of that character. So that's how that role developed. With the dark, and I, some of these roles, you're absolutely right, probably feed into each other. I mean, it's nothing new that people get typecast in certain things, and I always welcome that because it provides a challenge to break out of that mold. But I can only imagine that being on Lost certainly helped me get in the room on The Dark Knight and perhaps be seen in that light as a sort of a role of authority. And I loved getting to play the mayor on both those films. And then, again, having worked with Carlton sort of in that vein and a role of some kind of authority. I guess Richard Appel was a consigliere to Jacob, but he had some level of authority. I think that led him to believe that I could play the sheriff as well. So yeah, lately I've had the privilege of working in these roles that I thoroughly enjoy. I mean, I love nothing like playing a guy who thinks he owns a town. I think I'm sure Eric, most actors you've talked to, they love to sort of bounce around and try completely different things. And so I just returned to Wilfred, where I got to play a sort of a whiny jerk. on that show, I played it a couple times before, and I always love to sort of go completely the opposite to what I'm currently doing as much as I can.
That's right. I did just see that too. Although that's not a show that I've watched. I kind of have to pick and choose, you know, because
oh, of course
we are America's most haunted, and so I really do have to pay attention to kind of anything that may fit within that framework. Plus, I'm interested in all of that as well. And I suppose there's not really – I was just thinking about this, actually. It just occurred to me for the first time, there really isn't a paranormal element to Bates Motel, although there's obviously a horror element. I mean, you don't get a whole lot more iconic horror than the prequel – to Psycho, but it just occurred to me. So I think that says something that about the mood, the success, I think, of the mood that the show creates and the setting that I've watched every episode. I mean, from day one, you know, kind of breathlessly. I just watched it tonight just because we had to do something last night, but I mean, I've watched it, my wife and I watched it breathlessly every time. And for it to just be, you know, at the end of season two occurring to me, you know, there really isn't a paranormal aspect per se. Although I think the first season, there was slightly more of that implied, especially kind of early on when everything was still so up in the air. And about the girl, the Asian girl, and all that strangeness. We didn't really know what was going on there. This season's a little more, you know, down to earth and all. But my point was, I really do follow anything kind of remotely paranormal and more or less, the horror side of things. And what a tremendous show this is. I guess now it's also occurring to me that beyond – I guess it's you – technically, is it just you and Carlton that are the Lost connection? But there's something about the show that feels a lot like at least elements of Lost. Lost was so all over the place and crazy. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was like 10 different shows, but elements of it,
sure.
You know, this.
That's a very good point. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I think when I remember talking to Carlton years ago when I first started on Lost, you know, I asked him many questions about it, and I said, what do you attribute the success to the show? Because you're right. I mean, it is sort of a hybrid of so many genres, you know, sci-fi elements, paranormal elements. It's a drama on the one hand. And he said, really, at its heart, it's mythological. It's got literary and biblical allusions. But he said, at its heart, it's really a great opportunity for us to do incredible character-driven work. And that's really what it was. It ultimately was a show that explored so many different characters in such a rich way, in such an in-depth way that viewers could identify with any one of them, if not several of them, see themselves in that character and want to, you know, sort of avoyeristically, maybe experience life under those circumstances through the prism of that character. So the more you found out about the characters, the more invested you became in them, and they were all deeply flawed characters, which is infinitely more interesting than characters that obviously two-dimensional characters. And I think the same goes for Bates Motel. We have again a host of deeply flawed characters that are really well drawn by our writers, by Kerry and Carlton and the whole writing staff, which is. Again, it's well investigated, and it allows the viewer to hook in and really sort of invest in them and believe that these are real people and certainly the actors, all of us. The more misbehavior we have to play with, the more fun we have, playing the part, because it's kind of why you get into acting is to live a very deeply flawed character. So
without having
to see the perils.
Without having the consequences in real life.
Exactly. So going home to the comfort of your home and your family, exactly, and leaving it all at work. But, yeah, for in the moment, having to do pretty horrific things, feels good as long as it's under somebody else's name.
That's a great point. I'm not sure I've ever had an actor put it just that way. That's a really good point. Very interesting. I'm going to have to contemplate that. You know, while you were just talking, I thought of one other kind of, I guess, specific element of commonality, and it's not obvious, and it's probably somewhat subjective, but time is such an important, almost a character unto itself in Lost. I mean, because you had...
Oh, yeah.
You know, leap forwards, leap backwards, parallel timelines. I mean, it was playing with time in a way that no other show had ever come close to doing before. And while things are generally happening in a linear manner in Bates Motel, although we do have certainly some flashbacks, but in general it's fairly linear. But what I've been thinking about in one of the underlying dramatic elements of Bates Motel is we know ultimately how it ends.
Sure.
We know the
sure.
ending.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
So
that
right.
the time
it
is attenuated in some way, I guess, you know?
That's exactly right. No, it's a very good point. You're right. Time, yeah, there's definitely parallels. You know, not strict parallels, but you're right in the sense that Carlton and Kerry are playing with time as Carlton and Damon Lindelof played with time on Lost. You're right, and certainly knowing the ending or what we perceive to be the ending, and who knows if there'll be some twist on it. I can only imagine that there might be. I mean, I don't know. I genuinely don't know. But, you know, I wouldn't put it past Carlton and Kerry to have obviously a spin on just rather than ending on the original film. But we have a sense that we certainly know where the character's going, where he's headed, the path he's headed, and Norman Bates. But the issue of time that I think is intrigues me also is that there's a nod to the period, of the original film, in the clothing, and Vera's clothing, and Norma's clothing, and the car she drives, even her manner and Norman's manner just feels from another era, even though it's meant to be modern day. So there is a nod to that time. And so when you see a cell phone in one of their scenes, it almost feels a little anachronistic, but then until you realize, oh, no, this is present day. It's just that these characters feel like they are stuck in a time warp. So it's certainly purposeful that they've had Norma sort of wear the clothes, and Vera's collaborated with her incredible wardrobe and costume designer, and that Freddie has affected sort of maybe sort of a more mid-Atlantic kind of 50s accent. So that's all purposeful, but it definitely, for me, it throws me in the issue of time, but in a great way.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't even thought of, I mean, I guess I'd realized it, but I hadn't made it quite as explicit as you did as far as the clothing and the manner. Certainly the house itself, the house that they live in, I mean, that's it, you know, that's the direct connection. It's almost the character itself. But
sure.
you're right. It has occurred to me many times, well, she sure is not glamming herself up, is she?
No. Yeah, she's not getting with the times. No, not necessarily.
But now, the way you put it, that makes absolutely perfect sense. And yeah, Norman, he's so bizarre. The fact that Freddie is able to make him that we care about him, you know, we're concerned about him, although we know he's just an unhinged killer. And not only does he kill when he goes into these trances, where at least until now he really didn't have any awareness or knowledge of what he was doing or culpability, I suppose, in theory, for his behavior. But I mean, now we just had this right at the end of this latest episode in the box. You know, I was thinking, are they going to use the box as this concentration? He can't escape. He can't divert himself. Is he going to have to finally come to terms, you know, with what he's done? And of course, that is what happened. But again, it's amazing that we're able to. And as flawed, obviously, as Norma is, I mean, she can be so charming, and you know, all these hot teenage girls like frickin' Norman. I want to know what town that is when I was that age, and I wasn't nearly as dorky as he is, and man, all the hot teenage girls were not running after me.
He's a very charming man, Mr. Cody Highmore. No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's he has a way. He has a way, and as does Vera. Max, all of them, the whole cast, of making them empathize with their respective characters. And you're right. When you talk about Norman, who we all know turns out to be the killer that he is, you know, that's what I love about the show, is that it explores the genesis of that monster. You know, and so I guess you want to have a giant arc. You know, if you're going to do a series about it. And you want to at least start from the most innocent place, and Freddie has done that in spades. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, you care for him. You see how fragile he is. And another thing I think the show, another question it raises, which I think is, at its heart, is how much of a psychopath is born, and how much of him is bred. You know, how much of him is nature versus nurture. And I've spoken to a few psychologists about this, and that typically most psychopaths are pretty hardwired, but there are a handful that they've studied that, you know, could be malleable, could sort of be on the fence. They could be by circumstances or abuse, or they could sort of go worse, or could potentially the medication get better. And so I have to believe that Norman is certainly on the more hardwired edge, but he's definitely now been affected by external forces to become more of a monster.
Well, and poor Norma, who ultimately I do anyway, feel sorry for, but the way that she has has treated him, and the her she ultimately, though she, I don't think she would ever want to admit it, certainly not to herself, but, you know, she has made Norman as dependent as she possibly can on her emotionally to fulfill her needs, not Norman's needs. And that's her greatest crime. I mean, I think that's her role in creating this monster, is the fact that she has made him so completely and utterly emotionally dependent and has denied him, at least on the surface, at least in the open, you know, to have emotional relationships really with anyone else. She's fearful of that.
Absolutely right. I mean, she is as well-intentioned as she might think she is. You're absolutely right. She's certainly a huge part of why he is, well, they're so codependent, but why he is becoming so rebellious now. A huge part of the Oedipal sort of dynamic. I mean, she is definitely cultivating it, and you can only wonder how that's going to end, because we know the original Oedipus Rex didn't end well either. absolutely right. I mean, Norma Bates is an enigma. You definitely feel for her. She's extremely charming. She's a strong woman. She's a control freak, no doubt. She's a very broken bird. She's a broken bird who is clinging to the next best thing, or the closest thing to her, as a shield, and that shield is Norman in many cases. And you forget where one begins and the other ends. The umbilical cord clearly has not been cut. So it's a horribly dysfunctional relationship, and yet you so want it to work out.
Exactly.
And that's a tribute in large part to Vera and Freddie.
Oh, it is. It is. You're right. I mean, it really is like it is the path of the great tragedies, where you know how it's going to end, but until that moment, you're fighting, you're raging against the dying of the light. Just, maybe something will happen. Maybe someone will rewrite it right before I get to the end.
Maybe they'll get some therapy and you know, have a breakthrough. And I know,
anything,
right.
It could happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe
absolutely.
She'll marry Sheriff Romero.
You know, who knows? You know, I mean, maybe Romero can fix things. You know, and Romero would like to think he probably could fix things. And I guess that remains to be seen what happens, you know, between the three of them. But you're absolutely right. You know, the everyone around them feels that they Emma is so invested in both of them, and she feels
Saint Emma
that she can help. Yeah, God bless Emma, and she's being shunned by Norma, by everybody. We've all sort of, essentially told her to butt out. But she's highly invested in Norma and Norman as well.
And that was, of course, one of the most affecting moments thus far, is when Norman just so stridently came to her defense after she had the accident in the swimming hole. And man, oh man, you know, there's no question it's sincere, and you know, he cares about her, and he wants the best for her. I don't think there's anything untoward. I don't think there's anything underlying. I think that relationship is what it appears to be. It's probably the only relationship in the entire show that is what it appears to be. And, you know, all you have to do in terms of Norma's abilities as a parent is look at her relationship, her other relationship with Dylan. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, he has really risen. You know, he has come on. At first, when he first showed up, you know, whoa, we didn't know what to make of him, and I was very suspicious. And I mean, but he is the most trustworthy and reliable person, you know, again, other than maybe you and Emma, but Emma just doesn't have the gravitas at this point. You know, she right. This is a town where force counts, and if you do not have the threat of force behind you, then you just don't have the authority that those who are willing to wield that. I mean, this is a bloody, bloody town.
It is a bloody town. You're absolutely right. A very violent town. And yeah, you're right. Dylan is, I mean, so brilliantly played by Max, is a character that, you're right. If you can hang on to someone who has some level of goodness or a strong moral compass, ironically, it's Dylan, the one who's been betrayed by his own mother, the product of incest. I mean, he's got everything going against him. Well, he and Norman, both of them, but Dylan even more so. And he seems to rise to the occasion. And certainly this season, he's making a name for himself, and he's stepped into some big shoes and become a power player in this town. And Norman's probably greatest advocate.
Right.
Enough. I mean, that bond really secured itself by the end of last season, and it's an incredibly powerful friendship. And he's highly protective of Norman. It probably certainly in a far healthier way than his own mother is.
Oh, in a far healthier way, yes. Because poor Norma and Norman, that's the kind of relationship where they bleed inside each other's wounds.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Absolutely.
That's one of my favorite lyrics. I always use that whenever I can. It was
a
Melanie song. It was Melanie.
Is that right? But it is,
good old Melanie Sofka, way back, late 60s, early 70s. She wrote some interesting lyrics. So let's talk about you. What an interesting personal background. Why was it that you moved around so much and then you ended up at Harvard?
Yeah, it was I was very lucky. Both my parents are Cuban American, and they were born. I was born in New York. They exiled Cuba in 1960, and met in New York, and I was born there. And my dad started working at PepsiCo International, and through his work there, we were bumped around quite a bit. So I was, my brother and sister and I were lucky enough to get to see quite a bit of the world. We lived in London three different times, and we got bumped around to Venezuela, Mexico, and the Bahamas, and New York, Connecticut, and Miami. So we moved around quite a bit. I think I counted 12 different schools from preschool to college.
Oh, my.
I know. So we were, but the one beautiful thing for us is that we had each other, so we were our own constant, our family. So we were very tight-knit family. So we were very lucky in so many ways. And then I wound up I went to a boarding school in Massachusetts, and then I wound up going to Harvard, and it was there that I took an elective. There was no acting major for sure. There were only a couple electives, acting electives, and I took one, and I just got bitten. I studied a Meisner technique in that class, and I just wanted to keep studying it. It really intrigued me. And so then I had to drop that bomb on my dad after I graduated. That's what I wanted to pursue. After him putting me through boarding school and college. But God bless him; he was very supportive.
Fascinating. When you were moving around, did you and your siblings, did you always attend local schools, or were you ever? Because a lot of people in that situation.
Yeah.
Just kind of say screw it and homeschool. They just don't even bother.
It's a really good point. I don't know that homeschooling was particularly popular. I don't know. Maybe it was. We just didn't know about it. I mean, this is in the 70s and early 80s that we were traveling around so much. I mean, now you're right. Homeschooling is such a fantastic alternative, and in many cases the results are proving to be in some cases. Certainly academically, better than some private schools. It's incredible. But we didn't. We would go to the local schools, but that was exciting for us. It was also tough. Obviously you lose your best friends when you make friends and you have to make new friends. But it certainly made us more adaptable. It allowed us to sort of come into a situation and you know, we were forced to learn to adapt pretty quickly. And so in that respect, it was helpful, but it was always tough. I mean, I'm talking about the pre-internet days, so it was all writing letters. That's how you kept in touch with old friends. So it was hard to maintain all those friendships through the years. So that's what was tough about it.
Oh yeah, I had the town I grew up in Southern California was pretty heavily commuter. A lot of people coming and going, and what seemed to be kind of a common thread among the friends who came and went was they did have to get, you know, I guess on the positive, if you're going to look at it from a Darwinian standpoint, I suppose, you really did have to learn how to be very ingratiating and outgoing socially. I mean, because you had to fit in. You just didn't have the time to sit around and let things take their course. You had to get to know people. You had to kind of be able to get the lay of the land quickly and to sort of find your place as quickly as possible, because you could be moving on very soon. So those are some very positive, I think, you know, ultimately, skills. But as you said, the downside is it's very difficult to look at relationships, friendships, as long-term things. You just don't have that luxury.
Yeah. No, it's a very good point, Eric. And you're absolutely right. And, I don't have any sort of my wife is from Australia, and she has friends from preschool that she sees every year. We go to Australia. We try to go once a year. And she makes a point of getting together with her close friends from when they were 4 and 5. And it's a beautiful thing for me to see. And they're so close. I don't have those kinds of friendships. But like I said, my brother, my sister, and I are so tight that we became that for each other, as well as any siblings. But yeah, no, that's certainly one thing we missed out on. But like you said, the flip side of it is that we got to see a lot and sort of learn to adapt. And I suppose that, you know, that's a trait that's certainly come in handy here. And, you know, having moved to LA and having to hit the ground running when I first moved out here.
So, do you see a direct parallel between some of those skills that you really didn't have any choice, I suppose, but to learn, and then their application for acting?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I have to believe that in some way they are, because particularly if you guest on a show, you're a guest star, you come into a show that's very much a moving train, and you have to sort of hop on very quickly and make sure that you sort of fit in seamlessly into the tone of the show and into the pace, the way they shoot it. Make sure you get along with everybody and sort of learn the political ways of how the set works and not to rub anyone the wrong way. And so you kind of have to navigate that pretty quickly and learn it pretty quickly and assess it quickly. And so I can only imagine that's helped me in that way. I've been lucky enough to guest on a number of shows, I have to believe that in some way that's helped.
Do you have a favorite role that you've had thus far? Obviously, you're probably just getting started, as far as I'm concerned.
I know. You know, I'm having so much fun with this role right now, and I have to say this is, you know, it could very well be my favorite role. I mean, getting to play Richard Alpert was a gift, and I've been very lucky. I've had a number of great gifts, and that was absolutely one of them. I got to work on a show called The Tick a few years before that. It was a short-lived show. We only did 9 episodes. It was based on the cartoon. We did the live action Fox. And that was another role that I just absolutely loved. And so I've been very lucky. And again, you know, The Dark Knight as well. But this particular role, the role of Sheriff Romero for me, is a special one. And I've actually kind of adapted it, not adapted it, but sort of based it on a friend of mine who was a writer. I won't say his name, but
he knows who he is.
He knows who he is, and I have mentioned this to him. And he doesn't give up much. He's not a smiler, Not much of a smiler. He's not much of a laugher, so that's why we call him Chuckles. But he's a good egg. He's got a good heart, and he's a loyal guy, and he's always going to do the right thing. But he's definitely gruff, and he can be grumpy, and he's stingy with the smiles. But so when he does smile, it kind of counts. It counts. So I've kind of, loosely based it on him. So I'm having fun sort of tipping my hat to my friend when I play the role.
Very interesting. I like that. That's flattering, certainly to him, because I think, it really is a very successful, I'm guessing ultimately will be just as indelible as Richard Alpert. I mean, the only difference perhaps now is just the length of time in the part. One thing I wanted to get at, you're such a pleasant, seemingly more or less mild-mannered individual. Where do you pull that menace from? Because really, all your roles, there is a strong element of menace that gives you that authority. It's the implied threat. It's not when you're beating the hell out of Zane. It's the time when you're giving that steely gaze. That's even more menacing, I think.
Well, if I were to be completely honest and fair, I would have to attribute my calm demeanor to my father and my menacing face to my mother.
So they're a biological.
It's strictly nature, rather. Absolutely, there's nothing nurture about it. I can only imagine that there's some biological element to it. Yeah, absolutely. I definitely draw from my mother's strength and my father's cool demeanor.
You haven't done a whole lot of comedy, although, of course, I guess kind of your first really breakthrough role was Suddenly Susan, right? I mean, was that
Exactly. Yeah, that show was, oddly enough, it was the early 90s when I moved out here to L.A., and it was a time when, friends had broken out, and so just about every all the networks, there was only four at the time, were trying to copy that mold, and so sitcoms were plentiful, and there weren't as many dramas. ER was obviously a huge hit there, but Seinfeld, Cheers had already come and gone, but Seinfeld and Friends, and so I had to kind of adapt quickly to the sitcom world if I wanted to work. I got close on a number of films, but coming in second on features doesn't pay the rent or necessarily get you very far. So I needed to start working right away, and I had to sort of make comedy work for me, and I'd never studied it, so I had to sort of figure it out and the rhythm, and I looked at it more as a math problem. There's a sort of a musicality to it as well, and slowly I had more and more success in auditions, and eventually I landed a role of Lucia there on Suddenly Susan, and I did that for 4 years. So I ended up just for sheer survival's sake, working on a sitcom for 4 years. I had a great time, and then I proceeded to spend the next 5 years trying to murder that role, as you do when you do a role for a long time. You have to kill that character so you're not perceived necessarily as that role. But it was a fantastic challenge, and I loved every minute of it.
Can you see returning to comedy?
All the time. I love it. I just did this. I went back to Wilford just for a stint to do an episode, and I just remember how much I loved it. And I would absolutely. I'm always looking to find humor, even in the darkest of roles, because you want to find different. Even if a character is predominantly gruff, you got to find some element of a lighter side to the character as well. So I'm always trying to find something. To do a strict comedy, yeah, absolutely. I would love to do another one. If it presents itself, for sure.
It seems like you've done the majority of your work on TV? Is that just a matter of momentum? Are they? I know they used to be perceived, you know, a goodly long time ago. TV and film were really perceived as very different entities, almost to the extent that theater, live theater, and then either TV or film are. I don't think there's quite that because you have so many hybrids these days, and it, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell what's a movie, you know, versus
yes.
TV. But anyway, I'm just wondering. It seems like, you know, predominantly, while you've certainly had some key film roles, it seems like just numbers wise, anyway, the majority has
absolutely.
Been
yeah.
TV.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And when I started out, there certainly was still a bit of stigma to you know, doing TV if you're going to try and break into film. And you know, as I mentioned before, I was getting close on a number of, you know, studio films and some good parts and coming in second and third. And there came a time that when I said, well, I can continue down this and try and break through in film, you know, at that, you know, I was like 22 at the time and keep doing that. Or I could try my hand at TV and just start working, because really all I wanted to do was act. You know, at that point I was like, I just want to work. I want to get out there and play these parts instead of just auditioning for them. So I went down the role of, you know, of that particular sitcom of Suddenly Susan, which, you know, I spent 4 years on that. And absolutely, yeah, at that time, too, TV, George Clooney was really a huge reason how why TV actors were able to sort of, certainly a big catalyst in that change. So at that time, Clooney was leaving ER and breaking out in studio features, and slowly things started to change. But I did mostly TV, and then over the course of years, I would do the odd film here and there. You're absolutely right. The TV landscape has changed so much so, and even recently, and a lot of that, I imagine, is attributed to The Sopranos. I mean, raising the bar in the way that they did, where you're essentially watching a film every week. You know,
right.
It was indistinguishable from a great film that you'd go see in the theater. And I think that helped change TV. And certainly on the network side, I think Lost definitely had an impact in breaking boundaries as to what you can do on a network show, a serialized drama, playing with time, making it a hybrid, all of those things. So TV has definitely changed in the last 10 years immensely, to the point where a lot of film writers are now pretty much gravitating towards TV. So you have an extraordinary film talent that has left the film market to do these sort of shorter series orders on cable mostly. And so you're getting great programming, you know, from so many different networks year-round. So it's a fantastic, it's sort of the golden age of television for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and not just cynically from the volume aspect, because, you know, all those 1,000 stations have to show something. But,
sure.
I mean, you're absolutely right. There are a lot, including Bates Motel, very cinematic television
oh, yeah.
shows.
Yeah.
And across the board, from the production values to the talent, the on-screen talent to the writing. Yeah, I mean, there's no question that the advent of cable, and there's an aspect of the internet as well, because there's
yeah.
just one more source of competition, right?
No
and
doubt.
Even that's
right.
opening up. Now we have the internet as an outlet. I just saw, I think it was today, that Yahoo is going to join Netflix and
oh,
Amazon
yeah.
and whoever else is
ooh,
I'm
yeah.
sure.
Xbox as well, streaming through Microsoft. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's so many avenues now.
It's amazing. And so I think, I'm sure that's part of why there's a lot more fluidity. Maybe all of this, maybe there is still, though, this this barrier between live theater and everything else. Do you do
yeah.
Live theater?
You know, I started in theater, and I loved it. I did every play I could when I was in Harvard, and then one summer I auditioned in New York for an off-Broadway play, and I was lucky enough to get it, and it was a two-character play, and that really sort of helped to start my career in New York, that particular play called The Silent Thunder. I was 19 at the time, and I went on to do a bit more theater out here at the Old Globe in San Diego. But once I started working in TV, it just became harder for me to go back to it, just logistically. But that's the base. I mean, that's why I think most actors get into it, is they have that, you know, you get to tell a story from beginning to end without having to cut, and experience it and live with an audience and get instant feedback and feel the audience and, you know, and have that proverbial moment on stage where everyone feels it. There's nothing like it. It's extraordinary. So yeah, that's the source and the base of everything. And you know, I just now with kids, it's getting increasingly harder for me. When they get older, I'll go back and try and see if you do a play and get back on the boards.
How old are your kids?
9 and 12, two boys. So yeah, they keep us busy.
Oh boy, yes.
Do you have kids as well?
Yes, I have a wide spectrum. I have a 10-year-old boy, so right between your two. I have a 14-year-old girl, and then I have a 26-year-old boy and a 29-year-old girl.
Oh, look at that. Wow. Look at that. Four kids. Amazing.
Yeah, and it's really two and two, though, to be honest. You know, there was never four together. You know, I see people I see these mothers, you know, or fathers for that matter, wrangling, you know, four kids within, you know, I don't know, anything under 10 years is just crazy to me to think about, you know, that many kids in that time frame. And then you know, we get talking, and I got four kids too. Well, yeah, I do, but you know, it was really two and two. The reality is, you know, it was two in my 20s and two in my 40s. That's the reality of it.
Well, it's beautiful. You've gotten the chance to do it twice, and that's as you know, there's nothing like it. It's extraordinary.
Absolutely. And yours are, what, you know, great age. I mean, they're old enough now that you know who they are. They know who they are.
Yeah.
They have strong personalities. They have, you know, what they like and what they're good at. But they're still young enough to be enthusiastic. You know, they're still kids.
Absolutely.
And it's a great time.
Not completely cynical. No, it's a very sweet age. You're absolutely right. And I don't know how you felt, but I had the perception that you know, that a lot of this was nurture. You know, parenting was nurture. That you know, you pretty much can mold a child to a certain extent, but as soon as our second child was born, it was very apparent that there was a lot more nature than nurture going on when they came out. A completely different personality than the first one, and it became extremely evident that now they come out pretty hardwired, and there's only so much you can do to curb, you know, you can curb their behavior, but no, they are who they are.
Yeah, I don't think you can. I don't think you can push. You can't get behind them and push. You can try to lead. You can kind of take them by the hand and see, does this direction make sense? Does that direction make sense? All right. Well, if you're going to do this, then this, and this is probably a good idea. You know, if you're going to do that, then this, and this. But you're right. The thing that amazes me even more than how defined it seemed like kids are from a very early age in terms of, and it's not that they don't change, because you can see very abrupt changes, you know, just kind of out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, whoa, where did that come from? Although it's probably, you know, whatever the underlying reason for that change, that impulse was probably already there. But the thing that surprises me, or that I have a hard time figuring out, is it's not when they're, okay, this is me, this one's my wife, you know. It's those bizarre, strange hybrids. You know,
yes.
a little bit here, a little bit there, and then you mix it together, and oh my God, that's something completely different.
No, you're absolutely right. It is a mishmash. You're right of traits from both of you. And maybe even from your parents too, their grandparents as well. You see it too. Absolutely. They're mystifying. You're right. I kept thinking of Norma Bates. Yeah, her tact on Norma is just a slightly different one. There's no gentle guiding there. There's just downright manipulation. But yes.
Someone described
it earlier on. I'm sorry, what was
that? I mean, we all manipulate. I mean, let's face it. If you're a human, you manipulate. If you're a parent or a child, you manipulate even more. but there is a line, and Norma has long since crossed it, let's face it.
Oh, no doubt about it. No, you're right. It's a carrots and sticks approach for sure. I was going to say there's somebody, I remember when one of our sons was at preschool and mentioned to us about how they their parenting method, because I asked, how do you do it? And she had older kids. And she said, I have a very tight leash now when they're very young. And as they get older, I just loosen it and then let them go. And it's essentially, I was like, oh, that's a great way to look at it. You know, you rein them in, they need to know their boundaries now. And slowly, as they acclimate and get used to what the boundaries are, you let them go. The trust has been built and you let them go.
And you hope for the best. That is hard.
Okay.
Oh, I'm telling you.
We're not there yet. You've been there twice.
As you were saying those words, I was my daughter, the oldest, the one who's 29, she was gone. She went away to school, and then she was gone for a while. But then she came back, and she has actually lived in we're in the greater Cleveland area. She's actually been living in this area now for the last several years, and it's been wonderful. You know, we've been able to interact with her as an adult and see how she blossoms and grows as, you know, this young woman. And she's the third singer. Well, really, she's the lead singer. She's the singer in our family band with my wife and I. We have a cover band. And so it's really fun, you know, just I get to go with my wife and oldest daughter and, you know, play in dive bars. So, my son, the 26-year-old, so he was around, and he actually went to high school with me. We are talking two different marriages, and my daughter actually went to high school, it's about, I don't know, 60, 70 miles away, over at her mother's. So, you know, I didn't have as much time with her when she was younger. My son chose to go to school here, which upset her mother, as you can imagine, but made me very happy. So, you know, we had the whole high school years together, and then he went off to school. They actually went to the same college. But then a few years ago, he moved away to Denmark. I've only seen him in person three times in about 3.5 years. I'm thinking, 3.5 years. So, oh, my God. I mean, especially that first year, it was horrifying. It was so hard. I was just in despair. Bear, and I kept thinking, what is wrong with me? And then I would say, oh, Chris is gone. I'm so sad. So then I had this long, eventually, after about a year, I had this long talk with my daughter. And she said, look, I understand. I miss him, too. And they were very close. They are very close. And I miss him and love him and wish I could see him a lot more often. But here's how you have to look at it. You raised him so well that he can go off on his own and live his own life and be happy and be comfortable and make his way in the world. He met a woman in school. He went over for school, met a Finnish woman. They've been married now for a couple years. And, you know, they're both over in China right now because she's going for her PhD in freshwater biology. So she's over there doing some work and he's over with her. So, I mean, you never know where they're going to be. And it didn't really make it that much easier, but it did really give me some perspective that, yeah, you know, you're right. He is an adult. He's a grown man. He has to live his own life. And if he feels drawn to go, you know, halfway around the world, then if he can do that successfully and be happy and lead a successful life, then more power to him and good for us. I don't mean to imply just me. I mean, certainly his mother too. You know, we must have done a good enough job.
Yeah.
And so, that's a little perspective. And, of course, it happens to all of us. It'll happen to you sooner than you think.
Right.
But it looks like, sounds like you have a great perspective and you're certainly spending the time and enjoying it.
I'm very lucky to spend the time that I get with him. Absolutely. No, you're right, Eric, and your daughter's right. I mean, it speaks to the fact that he is able to travel so freely and confidently, you know, with his wife, you know, to China and to Denmark, and it speaks to his confidence and the fact that he feels that he can handle that. And so you've clearly done a great job, yeah, both of you. But my wife and I are very lucky. I mean, it's feast or famine as an actor. You're either working a lot, or sometimes you're just looking for working at home. So when I have downtime, they see a lot of me, and I'm very lucky to have that time to spend with them. I mean, we do shoot the show in Canada, and we're here in L.A. The family's here in L.A. The kids are in school here, but I do have to fly back and forth when I do the show. But that's only 4.5 months of the year. Outside of that, they get to see me quite a bit, which I'm very lucky. Very lucky about.
Yes, absolutely. Well, what a pleasure! Hard to believe the hour has come and gone.
Eric, that was a fast,
breezy hour. How fun! What a great guy! You're super articulate,
very
intelligent.
I really appreciate this. I wish you.
Oh, my pleasure! Absolutely, my pleasure. So, again, let's let people know what's going on. We have the amazing Bates Motel on A&E, and it's also available online on the A&E site, but it's A&E, 10 o'clock on Monday nights. And next week is the season finale, is that right?
It's a finale, yeah. And I believe I'm going to do an after show. I think Vera and Max as well will be there later on that night. So we look forward to... I think people might be even the some Twitter feed or something going on from what I gather, and hopefully we'll be able to connect with fans who've watched the finale.
Fantastic. That'll be wonderful. Yeah, I love social media. I mean, it's kind of like sometimes it feels like it's one more obligation, you know. It's, oh, my God, I got to do that too. But the opportunities for communication, you know, it's broken down so many barriers, and that – really is wonderful, you know.
No, it's extraordinary. Yeah, I'm a bit of a dinosaur. I'm only now just starting to join Twitter, but I'm going to catch up. I know it's clearly an invaluable resource, and I'm definitely going to start using at least Twitter for now.
Well, I have zero doubt that you can do anything that you put your mind to.
Oh, thank you so much.
you've been
very kind, and I really appreciate this. You know, this is a show that the whole cast and the writing staff we love so much, and for you to devote this much time to it, it means, I know I speak for everybody, it means a lot to all of us.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Loved talking with you. Super, super fun, interesting, charming guy. Great actor. Wish you nothing but the best. Looking forward to seeing you in whatever you have coming up. Obviously continuing with Bates Motel, but I will always be on the lookout for where you may pop up. And, again, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. And nothing but the best.
Mine. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Nestor.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, all right. Thank you. All right. Bye now.